The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We're off and running on another week of broadcasting excellence right here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in North Edmond, Oklahoma, our headquarters campus. Here in the UK, our beautiful, beautiful Edstone campus, and the work going on in this part of the world. Monday, we typically update you on the stats from the weekend program here in the UK, the Key of David UK, Man's Incomplete Mind, that's posted at thetrumpet.com. If you haven't seen that particular program yet, we offered the seven laws of success and also repentance toward God and the correspondence course. It brought in 138 total requests for the weekend, and also the MPC department here informs me that the packaging ads that we have on the envelopes here brought in another four additional responses. So I don't know if all 138 requested to enroll in the correspondence course as well as ordered those two booklets. But if so, even if it's a nice size chunk of that 138, together with those four additional students to enroll in the correspondence course, our numbers continue to increase. Later this week, I'll hopefully give you some updated figures on how many people in this part of the world we've enrolled in the correspondence course. Well, in March of last year, ABC News investigated the Iraqi militias that were fighting back against ISIS. And what they found out in this report, it was, as I say, a little over a year ago, it really was appalling. ISIS, we learned from that investigation, well, they're not the only extremist group going around torturing and beheading its victims in Iraq. It's also these militia groups that are fighting ISIS. And ABC said that there's no clean hands in Iraq's ISIS fight. They're all corrupt. They're all extremist. They're all carrying out unbelievable atrocities. But what was pretty amazing about this ABC report is that these Shia militia groups fighting ISIS were spotted carrying U.S.-made rifles. They were driving American Humvees. As I say, even as they were going about torturing their victims and even proudly displaying severed heads. This got quite a bit of coverage, this investigative report from last March. To quote from the report, it says, Shiite-dominated Iran is widely believed to support many of the PMFs, or the Popular Mobilization Forces, in Iraq. We'll have a little bit more to say about that group in just a second. That's basically the Iraqi forces. They're called the Popular Mobilization Forces in Iraq. And as ABC brought out last year, these Shiite-dominated groups are supported by and dominated by Iran. Now, that's not exactly breaking news to listeners of this program. Our listeners, our readers at thetrumpet.com, they know all about Iran moving in there and taking over. We know all about General Qassem Soleimani's involvement in Iraq. He's the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the leader of the Revolutionary Guard, who essentially rules Iraq. And he reports directly to Iran's Ayatollah in Tehran. The supreme leader there in Tehran has described Soleimani as a living martyr. So he's right in tight with the Ayatollah. Frequently traveling back and forth to the Iraqi battlefields. He was there right when the ISIS movement came into Iraq a couple of years ago. He's been directing the Shiite militias in their fight against ISIS. You might remember last summer this was. This is right after the West agreed to terms with Iran on the nuclear deal that Soleimani immediately violated the travel ban that was still supposed to be upon him. And he went off to Moscow to discuss arms sales with Vladimir Putin and his defense minister.
Aides to Secretary of State John Kerry said they are demanding answers about last month's secret trip to Moscow by Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, who is believed to have discussed arms sales with the Russian defense minister and with President Putin himself. The commander of Iran's lethal Quds Force, an elite special ops unit of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, Soleimani is credited with overseeing the killing of at least 500 American soldiers in Iraq, and his travel to Russia violated existing U.S. and United Nations sanctions, which bar Soleimani from all international travel, but especially to states like Russia, which sits on the U.N. Security Council and is supposed to enforce its resolutions and sanctions.
So he's barred from all international travel. Which means he has to stay in Iran. Yet he's heading off to Russia for an arms deal. An arms deal. And then back and forth into Iraq. Overseeing operations there to fight against ISIS. And as that Fox News report brought out, that was from August of 2015. He's responsible for killing 500 U.S. soldiers in Iraq. It was Soleimani who directed the shadowy war against American forces when America occupied Iraq. A shadowy war that put all kinds of pressure on the United States to get out. The former U.S. General David Petraeus, he once described Soleimani as a truly evil figure. He's a truly evil figure. I mean, Petraeus was right over there. He saw the influence of Soleimani up close and personally. He was right there in Iraq. He witnessed it. He witnessed a truly evil figure carrying out all these atrocities against U.S. troops. Today, he travels wherever he wants, including into Moscow to finalize additional deals for armaments. He's a man that has all kinds of American blood on his hands. And there's another man, we learned about him last week from the Wall Street Journal, who also has all kinds of blood on his hands, Jamal Ibrahimi. He orchestrated the bombings of American and French embassies in Kuwait. That was during the 1980s. He was given a death sentence there and then escaped. And then he was designated for sanctions. Also, not unlike Soleimani, he's designated for sanctions by the U.S. government in 2009 because of his efforts to destabilize Iraq and because of his involvement in killing U.S. troops. In fact, when U.S. troops were stationed in Iraq, it was Ibrahimi who orchestrated the delivery of the EFPs that many of those militia groups were using, those explosively formed penetrators. That's what EFP stands for. They're able to punch right through the armor of those American Humvees, those American vehicles. Last year, this exchange here, it was just a few weeks after the nuclear deal was signed, or I guess agreed to. It was finally signed in January, as we know. But they came to the agreement in July. And then during this Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, this is from July 29th, 2015, you'll hear Senator Tom Cotton. He's questioning General Martin Dempsey and Secretary of State John Kerry. And he sets it up by asking the general about these EFPs, these explosively formed penetrators.
Could you explain exactly what the bottom diagram shows of how an explosively formed penetrator works?
A copper cone is melted at super high temperatures and projected and essentially burns its way through armor plate.
The copper disk travels at about 6,000 feet per second. Could I have chart two, please, so we can see what happens to a Humvee when a ball of fire travels at 6,000 feet per second? General Dempsey, is that familiar to you?
Yes, Senator, it is.
Do you know how many American troops were killed by such explosively formed penetrators?
That particular incident or
no,
in general?
Several
hundred.
Was Iran a main supplier of these explosively formed penetrators?
Yes.
Was Qasem Soleimani and the Quds Force and the Revolutionary Guard Corps the main perpetrators in Iran?
Yes.
Secretary Kerry, those entities and Qasem Soleimani will ultimately receive sanctions relief from this deal, not necessarily from the United States government, but from the United Nations and the European Union. What should we say to the Gold Star moms and dads of the over 500 American troops who were killed by an Iranian ball of fire traveling 6,000 feet per second?
Well, we should tell them, obviously, first of all, how extraordinarily grateful we are for the service of their loved ones. We should also make it very, very clear that under the United States' initiative, Qasem Soleimani will never be relieved of any sanctions. It would also tell them and lay out to them what we intend to do, which has not been done yet sufficiently, to push back against Iran's behavior.
It's interesting there. That was, again, July 29th. And he said that, Soleimani would never be relieved of any of his sanctions. And this, the exchange brought out the same thing that the Fox News report did, that he's got blood on his hands. 500, at least 500 U.S. troops killed by these balls of fire supplied by Iran. And there's the Secretary of State saying, well, Soleimani's never going to have any of these sanctions relieved on him. And then he's right at the time of this exchange. I forget. I know we discussed it briefly on this program, but it was either right before this hearing or right after that he's off in Moscow. And then, as you heard from that Fox News clip, the aides to Secretary Kerry were up in arms. I mean, they demanded an answer. They wanted to know from Russia and from Iran what was going on. Why such blatant violations of these sanctions? I wonder what ever came of that. Our strong protest. I mean, to this day, supposedly there's still sanctions on Soleimani. And yet, look at what he's doing. Look at where he's able to go. He's the most powerful man in Iraq. That's the truth. He's the leader of Iraq, not the figurehead in Baghdad. He's the one calling the shots. And his right-hand man is this Ebrahimi guy. And the United States identifies him as a terrorist. And guess what his position is in Iraq? Well, he currently heads up the Popular Mobilization Forces, the PMF. He's Soleimani's right-hand man. And now he's heading up the Popular Mobilization Forces that are leading the charge to overtake Fallujah. We talked about the fight for Fallujah on Friday's program. You can see why a lot of those Sunni residents are not so eager to have ISIS booted out. They know what was going on. ABC knew about what was going on. What these Shia militia groups were doing last year and have been doing since. What a position to be in for the United States. You've got ISIS on the one hand, and you've got the king of the South, the head of the terrorist snake on the other. My father's made the point before how that ISIS really is just a huge distraction. Well, we fleshed this out on Friday. How that ISIS and the United States, they're giving cover to Iran. The Wall Street Journal, this is that report last week that really lifted the lid on this Ibrahimi fellow, Soleimani's right-hand man. The Journal said last week, this is June 2nd, to this day, the United States, or sorry, it says the PMF's role in the operation has already frightened and angered Fallujah's Sunni residents who fear the Shiite-led force will carry out revenge killings in a city that has long harbored Sunni extremists. It has also electrified the country at large, cementing for many Iraqis the omnipresence of Iran and its affiliates in their country. The omnipresence of Iran. Iran has taken over. These same Iranian proxies that were killing Americans on these same battlefields just a few years ago. And now, Iraq's strongest combat force, in the absence of the U.S. troops withdrawal, there are these PMFs. Headed up by Ibrahimi, and these are the partners of the United States. They're partners with America in the fight against ISIS, in the fight against the Islamic State. These Shia militias that once targeted and killed U.S. troops in order to get America out of Iraq, they now operate with impunity inside Iraq. It's no longer a shadowy war. They're heading up the militias, the army, the Iraqi army. Soleimani at the top. He reports to the Ayatollah. And under Soleimani, you have Ibrahimi. And America has encouraged all of this. We've encouraged them to go ahead, take the lead in this fight against ISIS. Max Boot had a piece in commentary a couple of days ago. He was writing largely in response to that Wall Street Journal piece, spotlighting Ibrahimi. And the title of Max Boot's piece says it all, trading one Islamic State for another. That's right. You have the Islamic Republic of Iran, and you have the Islamic State. They're both in Iraq. Boot writes, the push to take Fallujah will resume before long, and in all likelihood it will succeed, albeit at considerable human cost. The question is, who will benefit? The Obama administration and the American military will tout this as a big victory for the United States, the government of Iraq, and the anti-ISIS cause. In fact, it will be more of a victory for Iran than for anyone else because of the prominent role played by Iranian militias in this offensive. The Iraqi people know this. They know what this means. This cements for many of them the omnipresence of Iran in Iraq. The takeover is nearly complete. Who's the big victor here? And who's the real loser? As I've pointed out already, you don't have to go back even but a few months. And you have that riveting testimony or that exchange where Senator Cotton really just exposes how foolish and childish America's leaders have been. You have all of these Iranian-backed militia groups carrying out atrocities just like ISIS. And you have assurances along the way. White House spokesman, the president himself. Look, this nuclear deal helps us. Iran's hands are tied behind their backs. The sanctions are still on Soleimani. Those are never going to be lifted. Those will never be lifted. We know what they're doing. We see the terrorism that they're sponsoring. We're not, they were warning in some ways. Of course, it's when you lay it aside or alongside what they were doing behind the scenes with the nuclear talks. The statements are ringing hollow and hollower. Let me just take you back, just to give you some statements that you can compare and contrast, because you know where this is leading. It's just like what Max Boot said at commentary. As soon as Fallujah is retaken and Mosul and the others, the United States, they will, the Obama representatives will rush to the microphones to proclaim this as a huge victory for the United States, when in fact it's a huge victory for Iran. This goes back to December 3rd, 2014, so it's a couple of years ago, and this is Josh Earnest, the White House spokesman, during a press briefing.
At the same time, there are also reasons to believe that directly coordinating militarily with a country like Iran, and a country that actively supports terrorist organizations, that it's not necessarily in the best interests of our military personnel to be sharing significant intelligence information or to be directly coordinating with them militarily. At this point, our calculation about the wisdom of cooperating militarily with the Iranians has not changed. We're not going to do it.
We're not going to cooperate with them at all. I mean, they're sponsoring terrorism. Now, we've got to go ahead and pursue this this nuclear deal to slow them down. But look, don't take that as a signal that we're now partners, that we're now friends, that we're now cooperating, that we're now sharing information. Here's what the president said that same year, a few months earlier.
You know, our view is that Iran can play a constructive role if it is helping to send the same message to the Iraqi government that we're sending, which is that Iraq only holds together if it's inclusive, and that if the interests of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd are all respected. If Iran is coming in solely as an armed force on behalf of the Shia, and if it is framed in that fashion, then that probably worsens the situation and the prospect for government formation that would actually be constructive over the long term.
Now, that was in June of 2014, and just a few months later, March 2015, that ABC report comes out about all of these Shia militia brigades beheading Sunnis in their response to ISIS, in their fight against ISIS. He says there, look, they can play a constructive role if it's an inclusive arrangement. If the Sunnis have say, if the Kurds have say, they can't just come in solely as an armed force on behalf of the Shia. Otherwise, the situation worsens. And so what's happened since President Obama made that statement 2 years ago? Well, the situation's gotten much worse. And yet, as Max Boot said, it doesn't matter. Because now the sound bites, the talking points, coming after the retaking of Fallujah and other cities, you know what it's going to be. In fact, we've already heard words to this effect. This is from the State Department spokesman, John Kirby. He said this last week, June 1st.
What I can tell you is that we continue to support Prime Minister Abadi's efforts in prosecuting the war effort against Daesh inside his own country, which has almost since the beginning included some what we call popular mobilization forces, or Shia militia, as you might add. Not all of whom, I might remind you, are under the thumb of Tehran, as has been often, I think, misunderstood. Prime Minister Abadi is trying to lead an inclusive effort against this terrorist group inside his own country, and we continue to support his efforts to do so.
So he's trying to make it inclusive. It's true there are some Shia militia groups in the mix, but not as many as you might think. And we're happy with his efforts, with Prime Minister Abadi, with how he's prosecuting the war against ISIS, as if he's calling the shots, as if he's leading the charge in Fallujah. Spokesman Kirby went on to say this.
Well, what we have said from, again, the very beginning is that to the degree Iraq's neighbors are going to play a role with helping Iraq fight Daesh, we want all of them, to do it in a way that doesn't further inflame sectarian tensions or increase those tensions. But that the inclusive approach that he's taking, if it can be effective on the battlefield, well, then that's a good thing, and obviously we want to encourage that.
As Max Boot said in that commentary piece, only in the minds of American officials can the approach of Shiite militias be described as inclusive. You're going to hear a lot of that in the weeks and months ahead. The United States praising these groups, the popular mobilization forces, for being so inclusive. But look, what's the reality? The Wall Street Journal brings it out last week. Max Boot followed up on that. You have that ABC report from last year. You have the blatant violation of the sanctions, the travel ban. Soleimani going to Russia to arrange for an arms deal. Ibrahimi, these guys have blood, American blood, dripping off their hands. And they control Iraq. Notice what Max Boot says. At the moment, however, Iran and its militias are able to take advantage of the American intervention in Iraq to pursue their own interests. As Ibrahimi often likes to say, the Americans may have the skies, but we own the land. That's what Ibrahimi himself says. He's on the ground. He's on the outskirts of Fallujah right now. The Americans might have the skies, but we own the land. Max Boot says he could go even further and admit that the American control of the skies is furthering the militia's control of the land. Now, this is what we brought out on Friday's program. The American control of the skies, it's helping the militias. It's helping the popular mobilization force. It's helping Ibrahimi. It's helping Soleimani. It's helping the Ayatollah. That's the truth. This is a high, indeed unacceptable price to pay for rolling back the Islamic State. Max Boot writes, in conclusion, the U.S. is, in effect, substituting one Islamic State, the one headquartered in Tehran, for another. That's not a trade-off we should make or have to make. See, it's one Islamic State for another. And the one that we're rallying behind is working to build a nuclear bomb so that it can destroy Israel and attack the United States and attack Europe. The one we're showing support for is the one that sponsors terrorism, the leading state sponsor of terrorism in the world. The United States leaves in 2011, I think it was. And look who fills the power void. Iran's just devoured that neighbor. It's devoured Iraq. And of course, we told you this would happen as far back as 1994. Is Iraq about to fall to Iran? That was a headline in the 1994, December 1994 trumpet. 22 years ago. Who could have predicted that? Who else made a statement similar to that? As I said on Friday, Bernard Lewis has gotten a lot of praise over this past week as he passed his 100th birthday. And he should be praised. He's quite a scholar when it comes to the Middle East, when it comes to radical Islam, when it comes to the Crusades, when it comes to the clashes between Christianity and Islam. But who else could have said, is Iraq about to fall to Iran? That was in 1994. We've repeated it over the years. We had another version of it appear in 2003 when the United States was invading Iraq. And my father, in that version, the 2003 version of the article, he spotlighted Iran's role in the region, its nuclear ambitions, its weapons programs, its sponsorship of terrorism, and its efforts to undermine American interests in Iraq. My father asked this, I believe this was in June of 2003, right as the U.S. forces were getting started. He said, so what will happen to Iraq when America and Britain can no longer support it? There's going to be a radical change in world events. That's right. What happens when America leaves? We were already talking about that when America was just entering the region. Okay, there's a strong show of force here. It may look unlikely that Iran would emerge as the king over the region. But what happens, we asked in 2002. What happens, we asked in 2003, when the United States leaves? What happens when America and Britain can no longer support Iraq and Afghanistan? My father asked this as well in that 2003 article. He said, can you imagine the power Iran would have if it gained control of Iraq, which was at one time the third leading exporter of oil in the world? Can you imagine the power Iran would have if it gained control of Iraq? Well, Iran knows. Iran knows what kind of power it obtains. And now it's, as I said earlier, it's no longer a shadowy war being fought beneath the surface in a clandestine manner. It's just out there in the open. Ibrahimi strolling into Fallujah, Soleimani back and forth from Tehran to Baghdad and wherever else in Iraq, and into Russia if he needs more military hardware. Daniel 11 and verse 40, you know it well. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. So the king of the north is going to respond with lots of military hardware of its own, chariots, horsemen, ships. And so where else do you read about the revival of Germany, about the dominance of Germany in Europe, about the rebuilding of Germany's army, about the calls for a European army? You hear it here first. And then it begins to make its way into the New York Times and other publications. This is in this morning's New York Times. In a reversal, Germany's military growth is met with Western relief. Well, the West is relieved by this. Finally! Finally, Germany's going to carry its weight! The New York Times says this, you know times have changed when the Germans announced they are expanding their army for the first time in 25 years, and no one objects. This is a great victory, you see. Good for Germany. Good for Germany to build up its army. We're happy with Iran. We're happy that it's an inclusive group. What more could the United States do to accelerate so many of these end-time prophecies of God? You know times have changed when Germany announces it's expanding its army and no one objects. Last week we talked about Article 9 in the Japanese Constitution. We talked about the joint statement from Britain and the United States after World War II with respect to Germany, that it would never rebuild its army, its armaments. It would never be able to disturb the peace of the world. Never, never. Well, the New York Times does a pretty good job of just giving a snapshot of the last 25 years or so. It says, back when the Berlin Wall fell, Britain and France, in particular, feared the reemergence of a German colossus in Europe. Let me repeat that. When the Berlin Wall fell, that's in 1989, Britain and France, in particular, feared the reemergence of a German colossus in Europe. But not today. Not today. Germany can dominate. They can expand their military, and no one objects. The Times says, by contrast, Berlin's pledge last month to add almost 7,000 soldiers to its military and an earlier announcement to spend up to 130 billion euros on new equipment for the military. These announcements, it says, were warmly welcomed by NATO allies. Warmly welcomed. They're to be applauded. The Times says it's taken decades since the horrors of World War II, but Berlin's modern-day allies, and it seems German leaders themselves, are finally growing more comfortable with the notion that Germany's role as the European Union's de facto leader requires a military dimension. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I read this and I'm just shaking my head. They've already gained control of the continent without, as we've noted before, without even firing a shot. And now the military expansion is the next stage, the next phase, the military dimension. The Times says here, perhaps none too soon, the United States and others, including many of Germany's own defense experts, want Germany to do even more for continental security and to broaden deployment overseas. President Obama expressed frustration in an interview this year that the United States, European, and Persian Gulf allies were acting too often as free riders. Donald J. Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, has been even more scathing in his remarks, threatening to pull out of NATO if he's elected. You've got to take care of yourself. You've got to build up your own military. You've got to be responsible for your own defense. And so they're doing it. We head out of Iraq and we hand it over to Iran. And then we say, hey, great job, Iran. Great job at taking over. We really like the way it's inclusive. Do you think Soleimani and Ibrahimi care at all about what the Kurds might think? I mean, they may go into Fallujah and exercise some restraint and not just massacre the Sunnis in there that hate them. But judging by that ABC report, just from a year ago, I don't think we can rule out a massacre once they take over. Is Iraq about to fall to Iran? In 2003, my father wrote, "I have believed for years that Iran will lead the King of the South and clash with the European Union, the King of the North. Iran is far ahead of any other Mideast country apart from Israel in developing nuclear warheads and bombs. They're very aggressive. They're a very aggressive force that will be stopped only by a superior force. And you should note that that superior force is now forming in Europe, certainly not in America, certainly not in Britain." We're drawing that much closer to this spectacular clash that happens at the time of the end. The King of the South pushing and pushing and pushing, and then the King of the North finally coming against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does He allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Welcome back to the show. In the next Trumpet print edition, this would be the July 2016 issue, my father has an article in there titled "The Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III." There's some compelling graphics in there. Just how many of these regions in and around the Mediterranean Sea are in absolute turmoil. And in this piece, my father takes us through some important history. The article, by the way, is posted at thetrumpet.com. It was featured, I think, one of the days last week. But I'd encourage you to go back and to read through that article, if you can take the time to do that. My father talks about the accelerated timetable that we're now on with all these hotspots in and around the Mediterranean region. Malta, Cyprus, Libya, Syria, of course, borders the eastern Mediterranean there. And then the nations around Syria, like we covered in the first segment, Iraq, Iran, Egypt, of course, has had its share of turmoil in the last 5 years. And then look at some of the nations at the southern edge of Europe, like Greece. Look at the refugee crisis flowing through Turkey, or those trying to get to Italy from these old fishing boats leaving the coast of Libya. So many dramatic changes just in the past few years. This article here, I went back to look at my father's piece from last week. I think it was posted after Brent Noctegal sent me this article today. This is from the Washington Times, June 5th, titled "Vortex of Turmoil, Vacuum of Power." And then it says here, "At the core of NATO's southeastern flank and the nexus of the Middle East, North Africa, and Southern Europe, the eastern Mediterranean region a half decade ago was relatively serene." Just a half decade ago, just 5 years ago, this was a relatively serene spot on the earth. It says Egypt, Libya, and Syria were ruled by enduring dictators. Turkey's falling out with Israel had been triggered by the notorious episode to crack the Gaza embargo. Remember that? That ship that tried to crack the embargo? That was big news. That's nothing compared to what's going on now in Turkey, in Syria, in North Africa, in Southern Europe, in the Middle East. It says here the economic depression in Greece had begun, but its severity was not yet apparent. Cyprus was governed by a communist, but with very little regional impact. This is just 5 years ago. Relatively serene. Today, the transformation of the complex political and geostrategic environment of the broader Mediterranean region, whose regular problems were generally manageable, has been stunning. It's been stunning, this transformation. My father's title, once again, "Mediterranean Battle Escalating into World War III." If this particular author at the Washington Times only knew, he knows a fair bit about just how bad the situation is right now in this region. And it's been brought on by what? By the disappearance of American power. This was stressed on the Trumpet Hour Friday's program. You see, the United States, in the midst of a stunning decline in worldwide power and influence. Later on in this article, it says Russia and China have repositioned their armed forces into and within the region, this Mediterranean region. As a result of its Syrian operations, Moscow has reinforced its military posture in its naval base in Tartus and its air base in nearby Latakia, from which it exercises de facto control over all of Syrian airspace via its advanced S-400 surface-to-anti-missile system. Joined to Russia's renewed military position in Crimea, from which it seeks to dominate the Black Sea. It says further, in addition, Russian diplomatic overtures have increased significantly, including to Greece, Cyprus, Israel, and even Egypt. Further on, the Washington Times says, the Eastern Mediterranean for decades was ordered by unchallenged American sea and air power. That robust American military presence under the Sixth Fleet guided NATO's regional operations, assured allies, projected sea and air power, and influenced power balances throughout the periphery effectively for decades. That's what maintained the order. That's why it was so serene. Because it was ordered by unchallenged American sea and air power. All that is now gone, or at least much of it is. It says here, according to the United Nations, about 15,000 shipping transits pass annually through the Suez Canal, linking Indian Ocean and Red Sea, commercial shipping lanes in the Eastern Mediterranean en route to markets in the United States and Northern Europe via the Straits of Gibraltar, to Eastern and Central Europe via the Greek port. Of course, again, you can look at Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, and see that once those curses set in on Israel, the pride of our power will be broken, our strength will be spent in vain, and we'll lose the sea gates that we used to control, that helped us to maintain order and serenity in regions just like this. It says later, if terrorism, piracy, or speaking of all this flow of traffic through the Suez Canal, if terrorism, piracy, or a naval blockade were to successfully shut down the canal, maritime shipping between Europe and South Asia would have to circumnavigate Africa, increasing the sea voyage distance by about 4,300 miles. Well, it just talks about what happens when there's no righteous power overseeing it. Maintaining control, ensuring the safety of these vessels. It says at the end, at the crossroads of Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, connecting Asian commerce to Europe and North America's East Coast, and struggling with furious sectarian battles and geostrategic military engagements, the stabilization of the Eastern Mediterranean Sea is more critical to the international order than ever. Well, it goes on and says how that the next president of the United States needs to engage. He needs to be energetic and decisive. But the thing is, if that next president happens to be Hillary Clinton, it's going to be more of the same. And of course, Donald Trump's already made his views. He's made his views known. He's unhappy with the U.S. carrying the burden, the financial burden, the military burden of NATO. He's unhappy with all these war efforts abroad, in Iraq, wherever else. I mean, if Iran's basically just being given Iraq, or it's handed to them on a silver platter, you've got the U.S. over there, as Carolyn Glick brought out last week, providing cover for them. But if anything, Donald Trump would just take it a step further. Say, you can have it. We don't want to have anything to do with it. Look at the direction. Look at the trajectory we're on. And take a moment to just appreciate how many dramatic, transformative changes we've witnessed in just the last few years. You can put in that same bracket of 5 years, as brought out in this Washington Times piece, the fact that 5 years ago, the United States controlled Iraq. We had troops there by the tens of thousands. But not today. Not today. So many prophecies to think about and to wrap our minds around, not least of which Daniel 11:40, but so many others as well. I would urge you to pull the United States and Britain in prophecy off of the shelf and to be reminded not only of our identity in prophecy, as that book just thoroughly proves from cover to cover, but familiarize yourself once again with the strong warning of that book, particularly in the last three or four chapters. That's what we need. That's what our peoples need to read. That's what people in the United States and Britain need to be reading. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. Send us some emails. You can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us again today at the start of another week. And we'll look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.